Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
How do you define poverty in the United States? Is it a state of being? Is it a number or a line? When you think of poverty in America, do you think of someone like Violet Carter?
I'm a disabled adult, so fortunately my work is entirely remote. I work for a small socialist nonprofit, and they do a lot of things like mutual aid and other community building activities, and I handle their social media accounts. I currently make $17.50 an hour at this job, and I do 15 hours a week, which is pretty much all they can afford to give me right now. So that means I don't really qualify for any work benefits or anything like that. I got very lucky with the job that I have, but it's frankly not giving me enough hours to feel safe and secure in how much money I'm making.
Violet is 32. She lives in the small town of Louisa, Virginia, with her husband and four children, all under the age of 12. Another baby is on the way.
Until the middle of this month, my husband was a member of the General Assembly here in Virginia, in the House of Delegates. And since then, he has moved full-time to working on starting our farm. At his job for the General Assembly, he made a little tiny bit over $17,000 a year. He was driving Lyft part-time to, you know, fill the gaps. But when the pandemic hit, he wasn't really able to do that, because it would have exposed the small children in our house to the virus. We spend almost every dime of the income coming into our house on bills. We don't really have the ability to save money or to invest it in any meaningful way. We don't really have a lot of money to spend on investing in our own farm right now. So we're literally living paycheck to paycheck.
Violet makes $17.50 an hour at her job. Now, that sounds like a lot, until you remember that she can only work 15 hours a week, so that's about $260 a week. And if she worked every single week of the year, no vacations, while also being a mom of four, she'd make about $13,000 a year. When her husband was at the Virginia General Assembly, they had another $17,000, so the Carter family, at best, could have been pulling in around $30,000 a year. So you remember how I asked you, how do you define poverty? Well, if you define it as a number, annual income, the Carters are living in poverty. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services 2021 poverty guideline for a family of six is $35,580 annual income a year, which means Violet and her children qualified for Medicaid and food assistance.
I went on food stamps for the first time when I was pregnant with my firstborn, which was over 12 years ago now. And it was actually a very easy process. I went in, I explained my, you know, economic situation, I filled out the paperwork, and within, I think, 5 days, I had a card and I had food. We were on the SNAP program for, I want to say, about 4 years before my ex-spouse got promoted at their day job, and we made suddenly, I think it was $20 over the limit. And so we got taken off food assistance. And that was a big struggle at the time, because $20 was not some huge difference in our quality of living and our ability to pay bills.
So there, maybe you hear your definition of poverty. Not just a number, but a fixed number, a line. A big, bright line you can drift over by $20, or even by earning a few more dollars at work. Not enough to buy a pint of milk or a loaf of bread, but enough so that government food assistance disappears. Violet says she and her family, quote, made it work. What choice did she have, really? But then the pandemic dragged on.
We knew that my husband's employment would be coming to an end mid-January of this year. So back in September of 2021, we applied for food stamps. And we let them know our economic situation, and we actually had qualified for expedited service, meaning that our income was less than the cost of our housing. And we had, you know, small children in the house, so that meant that we were supposed to get signed up for the service and have food money, you know, within 7 days. The whole process actually took, I think, 2 months. So we had let them know before the food insecurity became a real problem, hey, you know, this is our situation. But they have so many requirements and checks and hoops to jump through to prove your income and prove that you're worthy of food.
Worthy. Well, there you have a glimpse of another definition of poverty. As a state of being in this country, something you did to yourself. Violet Carter says food assistance has been critical for her family. Last year, they also put those pandemic stimulus checks and the expanded child tax credit to work to keep the family afloat. Well, those lifelines are now gone.
The pandemic is still here, and the stimulus checks have stopped. The child tax credit has stopped. Our household was not even able to get the child tax credit for our newest, our 11-month-old daughter, because the forms that they promised that would be up by summer literally never worked, and now it's over. I am going to see that back on my tax return, but I really could have used those benefits to help my family, and I feel like so much of this was just very poorly managed. The pandemic is still here, and many of us have come to terms with the fact that we are on our own.
And so what have Violet and her family decided to do? They've decided to try to grow their own food for themselves and other families struggling to get by. You know that farm that you heard Violet casually mention way at the top of the show? It's not a big farm with a ton of acreage. It's not a boutique farm growing heritage crops. The Carters are trying to make do with what is essentially a subsistence farm in Virginia, USA.
What I really want people to understand is that we didn't get here by some accident. We have social services in place from our government that should take care of these needs. And frankly, a lot of them, if not all of them, are broken. Like even SNAP, which is extremely helpful, is so limited into how much help it can give people. There are a lot of requirements for income. There are a lot of requirements for, you know, do you have a job? Are you able to work? There are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of math involved in getting help. And I feel like that is so removed from what we should be focusing on, which is helping people who need these basic things that they need to survive.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A number, a line, a state of being. How do we define poverty in the United States? And do any of those definitions adequately capture what it means to be struggling to survive in this country today? So I want to ask, what would happen if we thought about poverty completely differently? What would happen if we looked at poverty as being impoverished of support? That's what I want to explore today. And Mark Robert Rank joins us. He's a professor of social welfare at Washington University in St. Louis and co-author of Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Professor Rank, welcome.
Oh, thanks a lot, Meghna. It's great to be with you.
And Amy Glasmeyer is also with us. She's a professor of economic geography and regional planning at MIT. Professor Glasmeyer, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So in order to go forward with this analysis, I first want to start by looking way backward. And Professor Glasmeyer, could you tell us the story about who were the people most essential in the creation of America's first definition of poverty, federal definition?
Back in the late 1950s, there was an increasing interest on the part of the federal government to recognize the existence of individuals who are unable to generate enough income to cover their costs. This was a moment of America believing it could pretty much solve any problem. And there was an undivided Congress, if you will, as it related to some issues associated with social welfare. In the early 1960s, there was a continuing conversation about this. And ultimately, after the unfortunate assassination of John Kennedy, Lyndon Baines Johnson was really concerned about poverty in the United States. And so he set about working with individuals in the federal government, and in particular one person, Molly Olshansky, to try to come up with some measure of poverty. It's a long and complicated story, but when it's all said and done, Molly Olshansky basically was trying to inform Lyndon Johnson of exactly what options we had to determine what inability to cover your costs might be. And she was detailed to work on behalf of the federal government to determine some type of measurement. And so Molly's original thinking was really said not to be used for policy, but what she was looking at was the amount of food that was necessary for individuals and households. And she came up with a measure based on that.
Wow. And so, therefore, Professor Rank, we've got 30 seconds before our first break here. I want to continue this story. But is LBJ and the War on Poverty, those Great Society programs, that is where we first get this federal definition, this line, essentially, this viewing of poverty as a line in America?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the idea was, you know, Johnson declared a war on poverty, and if you declare a war on somebody, you need to know the strength of the enemy. And so that's where this idea of a line in terms of defining poverty came from.
Okay, so I want to hear more about why that's so important when we come back from the break, and we're talking this hour about what would happen if we completely changed our view of how we understand what poverty is in America. And we'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're asking what would happen if we completely changed our conception of what poverty is in America, moved away from thinking about it as a line or a number, and possibly thinking about it as being impoverished of support. Really a different framework here. And we're joined today by Amy Glasmire. She's a professor of economic geography at MIT, co-creator of the Living Wage Calculator, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. And Mark Robert Rank is with us as well, professor of social welfare at Washington University in St. Louis and co-author of Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. And Professor Rank, I want to just pick up a little bit more with the story of how we even at the federal level, decided that it was going to be a line or a number, that either you were in poverty or not in the United States, because it seems rather important. I mean, what was it that LBJ was trying to accomplish that led to the necessity of even, you know, defining some kind of poverty line?
Well, again, as I said, if you're going to, you know, LBJ was famous for, you know, saying we're going to declare a war on poverty, and that in this rich, affluent country, we shouldn't have folks, you know, living in desperate conditions. And so what they had to do was to figure out, well, how many people actually are in poverty? And as Amy said, it came out of the out of Molly Orshansky and the Social Security Administration. And the idea was basically that we're going to draw a line, and if you fall below that line, your income really isn't going to cover the basic necessities that are needed for a minimally adequate diet. I mean, a minimally adequate lifestyle. And so that's what we do. You know, and as you mentioned at the top of the show, you know, for a family of three in the United States, that poverty line is drawn at around $20,000. So if you're a household of three, you make less than that, you're going to be counted as in poverty. And if you're above that, you will be counted as not in poverty.
And how much has that, the means by which we calculate that line, how much has it changed since the 1960s?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really hasn't changed. The only thing that's really changed is that each year it's updated to keep in pace with overall cost of living increases and inflation. But what's interesting about it is that actually poverty today is in some respects much worse than it was in, say, 1964. So in 1964, the poverty line for a household of four was about one half of median income. Mm. So you take median income, you look at where the poverty line, it was about one half. Today, it's at around one quarter of what median income is. So in other words, the distance between the poverty line and median income has gotten wider over the last 40 or 50 years. And in that sense, poverty today is much worse than it was in the past.
Wait, so help me understand that more. So it's a quarter of median income, meaning the line is relatively lower than it was before, or higher? I'm not quite getting
it. So in other words, the line has increased, but so has median income.
Uh-huh.
And so the difference between those two has been getting wider. So where people stand in terms of poverty is further away today from median income. So that's kind of a way of thinking about it and thinking that it's actually, you know, worse today than it was in the past.
I see. So Professor Glasmeyer, chime in here. How significant do you think that is?
Well, if we think about other industrialized countries around the world, we are drastically below what they consider a measure of poverty. So it typically is thought of as 60% of the median household income. And so you can see what the gap is, and our gap is actually increasing.
Okay. So you mentioned other countries here. We're going to just take that little tangent for a second because, you know, we've done shows over the past many years where we do this sort of comparison between the United States and other nations, mostly European ones at this point in time. And one thing that it has occurred to me is when we talk to people in these other countries, very rarely do they say, well, I am poor, and so therefore I'm getting government assistance. It's more like there's a presumption that government assistance is a basic requirement for everyone, that the support is something that everyone should be getting in order to live at to achieve a certain standard of living. So that's where I came up with this question of, you know, do other countries look at poverty as being impoverished of support, unlike here in the United States? What do you think about that, Professor Glasmeyer?
Well, I would say that our industrial country colleagues have a very different philosophy about well-being. In the United States, there's a saying, you know, everybody deserves a chance, but ultimately you're just supposed to make it on your own. So it sets up a view of what you deserve. And I would say from my experience that the recognition of deserving in other countries, which are our peers, is really very different. There is a sense that people should not be without housing, that people should not be without medical care or access to quality food. And in the U.S., we're much more ambiguous about it. We don't say it as straightforwardly as I just did. But the bottom line is you're pretty much responsible for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Professor Rank, chime in on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think, a key distinction is that in the United States, we really have this idea of the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. The deserving poor are those who are deserving of some assistance, and the undeserving poor are those who just need to get a job and so on and so forth. And so that kind of mindset has really led to the types of social programs that we have, which are, they are very hard to get, they're hard to keep, and they don't provide a lot of assistance. And, you know, we don't look at things like healthcare or, as Amy was saying, housing as a basic human right. We look at it in a different way. And the result is that, you know, these programs really don't provide much support. And in fact, that's why rates of poverty in the United States are so much higher than, say, in European countries, because we do so little to prevent people from falling into poverty and to get out of poverty. Mm.
This idea of deserving and undeserving, though, it's very, very deep in our cultural DNA, mm-hmm. though. I mean, mm-hmm. we're getting comments already from listeners on Twitter. Russell, he's saying, most are poor life choices and decisions, lack of will to do what it takes. Well, he's not alone. Look, let me say, because I'm just thinking, like, you know, Mitt Romney and his famous sort of makers and takers line when he was running for president. More recently, we've heard Senator Manchin reportedly having said he doesn't support the continuation of some of the policies and the Biden administration's Build Back Better idea, because he thinks that reportedly thinks that people might be using that assistance to buy drugs. I mean, it's something that's very, very profound in how we're not just on Twitter, but how we're even making policy. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, we are very much steeped in the idea of rugged individualism, and that is you do it on your own. You don't depend on others. You certainly don't depend on the government. And that's the mindset that we have used to understand poverty and sort of social safety net programs. And my argument is that that is basically incorrect, that poverty is, for the most part, a structural problem. It's the example that you gave of Violet perfectly illustrates that there are not enough decent paying jobs. There are many part-time jobs that don't support people. And as a result, you're going to have people losing out at that game. I use the analogy of musical chairs in some of my work to say that, you know, really what we focus on are who loses out at the game rather than why the game produces losers in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going on in this country. We don't have enough jobs that support folks. We don't have social safety net programs. And as a result, somebody's going to lose out.
Yeah. Professor Glasmeyer, please, I'd love to hear you more on this.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Senator Manchin's comments about his own countrymen in West Virginia. And what I have to say is that when we think about who decides who deserves and how we talk about them, it is actually often in coming from places where there is an internal conflict, and it's a historical internal conflict. I'm sure that Senator Manchin does not like to be the senator from one of the poorest states in the country, that he'd much prefer to have his state be more along the lines of the median that we see in the nation. And so there's a lot of internal construction of the identity of the poor and whether they're deserving. And what's interesting is when you look into the history of a place like West Virginia and you think about Appalachia, well, Appalachia was the place that John Kennedy saw when he rode in a bus and he was up in West Virginia and Kentucky. And he acknowledged that the circumstances that people were faced, an industry that was dominated by large corporations, a wage rate that was easily tampered with, a whole set of circumstances that made people essentially be poor, fundamentally be poor. And so, but it is interesting for us to recognize that you're not hearing a state like Massachusetts withdrawing support for public subsidies in a period like now. What you hear are places where there is an internal conflict.
Yeah. But even in a place like Massachusetts, I mean, that's where both you, Professor Glasmeyer, and I are, I am right now, there is an overriding vulnerability amongst hundreds of thousands, millions of people. And that leads me to then sort of a bigger question, and I'll turn this to you, Professor Rank, about, you know, I've been focusing on that strict definition of poverty, line, income number, et cetera. But how many people right now in the United States, so over the course of their lifetime, may come close or cross that line?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a question I've been interested in over a number of years. And it is, what is, instead of thinking about poverty as sort of a point in time, how many folks are poor this year, what's the lifetime risk of an American experiencing poverty? And as you noted at the top of the show, what my research shows is that between the ages of 20 and 75, roughly 65% of Americans, two-thirds, will experience at least 1 year below the official poverty line, which is quite conservative, and three-quarters will experience either poverty or very near poverty. So the point of this, and I think this is what you're getting at, well, we'll be getting at throughout the hour, is that the reach of poverty is really wide. Poverty touches a wide segment of the population. And the point of this is to say, poverty is not an issue of them, it's an issue of us.
Exactly. I mean, if you're talking about 3 out of 4 Americans over the course of their lifetime will experience some sort of significant impoverishment, that's America. I mean, that you who are listening right now, that's you. If it hasn't been, it might be. I mean, it's a huge number. So hang on here for just a second, both Professor Rank and Glasmeyer, because I want to turn now to Kai Sinclair, who joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Kai, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell me, are you one of those Americans right now who's experiencing life in poverty?
Yes, unfortunately. Things just took a turn for the worse, and so I unfortunately am in that bracket.
And do you mind telling us, could you share your story about how you got there, how that happened?
Of course. So pretty much I had a house for a little bit. I had moved to Charlotte in June from Raleigh. Because I just wanted a bigger space. I didn't know how much it came with having a house, though. I didn't buy the house. I rented it. And the rent was just too much. So they said that, of course, we could leave or be evicted. So we ended up leaving. But my income drastically fell short as well. And then my partner at the time also lost their job due to COVID. Mm-hmm. Because we all got contracted with COVID because they're a teacher. And one of their students, I believe, had it. And so because of that, right now we're kind of struggling going from Airbnb to Airbnb or hotels at the moment until we find something. A lot of it's in debt at the current time just because we owe back rent because it's just too much. It was just too much to pay. Right now, income is just not where it is at the time.
Yeah.
I do all my business through Twitter because I'm a spiritualist, so I do readings or I provide content, things like that. I actually recently also hurt my back, so it's actually very hard for me to walk at this time, too. So I have my staff or my, you know, I call it my staff, but it's kind of like a cane. So right now it's kind of just like a steady struggle at this point.
Yeah. You know, I read that comment from one of our listeners a little earlier saying it's a matter of choice, bad life decisions. People don't have the will to pull themselves out of this. I mean, is that you? Did you make bad decisions? Do you not have the will to increase your or to better your circumstances, Kai?
No, it's not that. It's like I've tried a lot, but many times I've actually tried to apply for benefits and I got denied, or I asked other people for help, like family, but a lot of my family either doesn't live around here or they just don't have the time or energy, or some of them actually have COVID themselves. And other times I was actually working very hard. It's just bills kept piling on over a period of time and things got more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What do you think would help the most right now?
I would say financial assistance, but right now it's just security at the time, stability, understanding what I truly need is really just stability at this point instead of hopping from place to place. And a lot of times that does come in monetary, but at the same time, it's just, I just want somewhere where I can feel safe and not feel like I'm being looked at a lot.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, of course. So the reason I pick Airbnbs is because mainly the houses, you get the usual house to yourself. However, I've been thinking about, of course, hotels because they're cheaper, at least a little cheaper. But sometimes I don't feel safe in hotels just due to trafficking. And I don't know which hotels are safe and which ones are not. It's not just me. It's me, my partner, and my other friend. And we also have three pets. So it's not just me. It's like pretty much almost like a household of six.
Yeah.
If I were to count the pets as my children. So it's just not as feasible.
Right. Well, Kai Sinclair in Charlotte, North Carolina. Kai, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Professor Rank and Professor Glasmeyer, hang on here for a minute. When we come back, we're going to talk about, again, different ways. What would happen if we really changed how we looked at what poverty is in America? This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're asking what would happen if we completely changed our view, our definition of what poverty is, moving away from the idea that poverty is a line in America, that either you're in it or you're not, and perhaps thinking of it more as the vast number of Americans who at some point in time may be impoverished of support. What difference would that make? I'm joined today by Mark Robert Rank. He's a professor of social welfare at Washington University in St. Louis and co-author of Poorly Understood, What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Amy Glasmeyer also joins us. She's a professor of economic geography at MIT and co-creator of the Living Wage Calculator, which, again, we'll talk about in just a second. But lots of comments coming in here. For example, Mark Kamenesk on Twitter saying, "No, poverty is not deserved. It's most often not life choices, but life circumstance. When my family went on assistance many years ago, it was because of a job loss. How did my wife and kids make poor life choices? Because I lost my job." And Keith Allen Cooper says, "One problem with lines is the cliff effect when someone's income rises slightly but puts them over the income level that qualifies for assistance. People see a decline in living standards if their earned income increases, which shouldn't happen." Professor Glasmeyer, this is an important point if we're talking about redefining how we think about poverty. And just talk about that cliff effect for a minute.
Well, so basically, if you have income less than the poverty line, you have access to certain programs that can provide you with shelter, can provide you with some level of food support, as well as access to certain levels of healthcare. But if you exceed that by a very small amount, then for it's not just a dollar for a dollar, it's the end of access to the programs. And so we really have a very severe way of treating people when they're actually trying to help themselves. And we don't think enough about the fact that somebody might have an intermittent job, but that could have a consequence for the access to just the basics, the pure basics.
Mm. And Professor Rank, I mean, you've called federal assistance or government assistance, social programs in this country, you've likened them to musical chairs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sort of the argument is that that we have a number of people sort of competing for a limited number of chairs, and somebody's going to lose out at that game. And who's going to lose out? Well, it's going to be people that are more economically vulnerable in terms of participating in the labor market. But on the other hand, we could step back and we could say, actually the reason why people are losing out is because of these structural kinds of things. The other thing that I would say that I think is really important in this whole conversation is the way, we're talking about how should we view poverty. And the way that we have traditionally viewed poverty, and some of your Twitter folks have commented on, is one of individual blame. There's something wrong with the person. What we should be doing is looking at this as a social and economic injustice, that there is something wrong in a country that is the wealthiest country in the world, where we have children going hungry, that is simply fundamentally wrong. And the other point that I would make about this is that it actually costs us a huge amount. So I did a large study a couple years ago, and what we found was that childhood poverty in the United States was costing at a minimum $1 trillion a year. And that's because we pay for higher healthcare costs, we pay for higher incarceration costs, we pay for a less productive workers in the future. So the question is, the question is not paying or not paying. The question is how we want to pay. And if we were smart about this, we would be addressing poverty, because that saves us a lot. And it's also the morally correct thing to do.
Mm. So a lot of this comes down to, again, I'm just going to return to that definition question, because to your point about the moral obligation we have to ourselves as a nation, that is actually embodied, again, in policies. And if I understand correctly, when we talk about a line or a number, basically the United States has stuck with, since the early 1960s, mm-hmm. an absolute definition mm-hmm. of poverty, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Versus
yeah.
a relative definition in other countries?
Yeah. And in fact, most countries use a relative definition of poverty. So European countries either use, 50 or 60% of median income. And what that gets at is what I said at the very beginning, that by using a measure like that, you're sort of saying, okay, if you're not making half of what median income is in your country, then you're probably, in not good economic straits. And that's the typical way in which most countries define poverty. And if we did that in the United States, our poverty rate would go from, in 2020, it was 11.4%. It would go to more like 16 or 17% using a relative measure.
Mm, but we're not doing that, to be clear. Are we still using sort of just like here's the number, $35,000 I read for a family of six, that you'd need to make in order to have basic needs met? I mean,
that's right. We've been using an absolute measure of poverty all during this period of time. And again, most countries use what's known as a relative measure. The other thing that most countries do in terms of thinking about poverty is they often define poverty as social exclusion or social disenfranchisement, which gets at this wider notion of a definition of poverty, that poverty is not simply a lack of income, it's also what it means. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the economist Amartya Sen defines poverty as a lack of freedom. And that's what, when we heard from Violet and we heard from Kai, what poverty does is it restricts what people can do. So it's a much broader kind of understanding of what poverty really means in terms of human lives.
Mm-hmm. Nobel Prize winning economist Amartya Sen.
Nobel Prize winning, yes.
Okay, so Professor Glasmire, you've been listening patiently here, and I really appreciate it, because now I want to turn to another huge issue that your research takes on directly. And that is, I've been talking about a federal number, right? Federal definitions of poverty. But of course, this is a very, very diverse country. And so you have created what you call the living wage calculator. So everyone who's listening right now, hop on the internet if you can safely. Hopefully you're not behind the wheel. And go to livingwage.mit.edu. That is Professor Glasmire's website. And in there, you can see, like, you can actually put any location, city, state in the country and see, according to her research, what a living wage would be. So, Professor, I'm going to do that right now. I'm going to just put in Reno, Nevada, because we have listeners there. I love you guys in Reno. Okay. And in Reno, Nevada, you have calculated that for two adults and one working with two children, a living wage would be $30.47 in Reno. What does that mean?
So would you repeat the family structure?
I just picked one with two adults, one working, and with two children.
Right. So what that means is, first off, the calculator assumes if there's two adults in the household, then you would estimate their wage rate as being equivalent to $30.47 an hour. So you need that amount to cover your very basic costs. And that's food, minimal clothing, shelter, transportation, healthcare, childcare, utilities. Those are the components of someone's basic cost of living.
Okay. So let me write this down. Okay, so we had two adults, one working with two kids, and in Reno, Nevada, a living wage would be $30.47 for that working person. Okay, let's go back to another one. Let's go to Seattle, Washington. What do you have for Seattle here? Now my internet's getting very slow. So I'm going to presume that it's a little higher in a place like Seattle. But your point is, Professor Glasmire, as I wait. Oh, there it is. Here it is. Okay. Two adults, one working, two children. In Seattle, the living wage is $35.99, as you calculated. So the point is that it costs different amounts in different parts of the country to have similar quality of life, right?
It doesn't just cost a different amount. There is a burden of accessing that level of income. And as a result, that figure often doesn't come up for people because there are constraints that they have in terms of distance that they have to travel, the limited amount of housing that's rentable within the community that they live in, that the doctor care that they need is a very long distance from where they live. So this is basically really looking at what would it take if you had access to those things. And what that means is, I mean, if we look around the country, there's lots of places, particularly in rural areas, where you don't have rental housing. And that's because the housing market isn't very flexible, or that there's one doctor in town and then you need something special and you have to travel much further. So this is just a basic understanding of, in a place, what are the ingredients for a life and what does it cost to secure them?
Huh. I think people might be surprised by what some of your analysis, the numbers that come up. I just put Columbia, South Carolina in here. And again, two adults in the family, two kids, one working adult, $33.32 to achieve a living wage in Columbia, South Carolina. So how does this information, Professor Glasmire, then help policymakers, or do you, how do you want it to help in terms of addressing standards of living across the United States?
Well, most of the time, people basically are telling me what they are making or that they are looking at as a quote unquote living wage. And then I walk them through what a living wage might look like based on the ingredients that are in the tool. Today is an interesting moment because, as you can see out in the labor market, there's a lot of turmoil. People are stepping away from jobs that are paying $7.25 because they recognize that it is not, it's not livable. And so they're finding other ways of solving the problem of the immediate need for the basics. At the same time, we're seeing something that's, I think, quite remarkable and also a potentially positive sign. And that is, if you ask me who I talk to on a daily basis, I'm more likely to be talking to a corporation somewhere or an employer. And they're asking me what is the right wage that they should be paying. So I'm beginning to feel that there's this tide that has for the longest time been way out, and it's sort of rolling in, and people are saying, you know what? $7.25 doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't make any sense anywhere. What we have to look at is what it, what people require to get by or to actually get by, but to not feel, as Mark was suggesting, economically insecure. Mm. So this is a very powerful moment. And we're really seeing divides forming in the country. And that is, where am I hearing the majority of employers talking about changing their wages? It's a lot more in urban areas than it is actually in rural areas. So even as we're having conversations about raising wages, there are still differences that are accountable to where you are and the opportunities that you face.
Professor Rank, do you also feel perhaps some kind of special energy in this moment because of all the factors that Professor Glasmeyer was talking about?
I do. I think that you know what we're talking about is, again, a structural kind of issue that folks are not, you know, are looking for a living wage. But let me make a little plug, since we're talking about calculators. I think your listeners would be very interested. I've constructed what's known as a poverty risk calculator, and what you can do is you can go and you can see what your risk of poverty in the next 5, 10, or 15 years is. And I think that will be very, very eye-opening. It's a site that's called Confronting Poverty. It's all free and open access. And it's based on this life course work. So,
I'm looking at it right now. It's confrontingpoverty.org, people.
Yeah,
so,
that's it.
Yeah.
And it has a lot of information about just different aspects of poverty that we've been talking about. But, you know, it's, the idea is based on, like, sort of the heart disease risk calculator. So you put in your age and you put in your education and so on and so forth, and it will give you, based on, you know, lots of longitudinal research, what your actual risk of poverty in the future will be. And again, I think it's extremely eye-opening, because the point is that a lot of people are at a pretty significant risk of experiencing poverty.
Mm. Well, we have about a minute, just a little over a minute left, and I'd love to hear a last thought from both of you. Professor Glasmeyer, I'll just start with you. Do you think that it can be eventually possible to move away from that absolute definition of poverty that we've been talking about throughout the hour towards something more holistic and textured that reflects reality right now, for as long as America is as divided amongst various vectors as it is?
I'm not sure we're going to see a conversion of the existence of the current poverty measure. I actually think what we're going to see is a continuing evolution of what people are being paid on the basis of organizations, individuals, and employers, what they see is actually right. And the reason that I don't think the federal government is going to move quickly on this is because of the comments that were made about West Virginia and Senator Manchin. Mm-hmm. There's everybody has to make it on their own kind of attitude. And until that changes, we're going to be caught in this bind. But I think that people themselves are evolving.
Well, Professor Rank, you got the last 15 seconds of the show. Go ahead.
Well, what we need is a real paradigm shift. We need to understand poverty is an issue of all of us, not just an issue of them. And that's the kind of change that we need.
And my mind keeps going back to your analysis that 75% of Americans, 3 in 4 of us, will come close or experience poverty at some point in our lives. It's a remarkably shocking number. Professor Mark Robert Rank at Washington University in St. Louis. The website is confrontingpoverty.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Professor Amy Glasmeyer at MIT. Your calculator is livingwage.mit.edu. Professor Glasmeyer, thank you so much.
Thank you too, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.